Welcome to the deep dive. We are looking at a world that is, frankly, on edge today.
Very much on edge.
Yeah. It is March 2026, and from the gridlocked halls of the UN Security Council to active conflict zones in the Middle East and South Sudan, international diplomacy is currently facing, well, it's an unprecedented stress test.
Right.
And we have a lot of ground to cover today. We've tailored this specific deep dive directly for you, the listener, to cut through the noise and look at the underlying mechanics of what is actually happening on the ground.
The sheer scale of the geopolitical friction we are witnessing right now is, honestly, it's staggering. I mean,
Yeah.
while these reports span entirely different continents, they all share this common thread. We are seeing extreme pressure placed on both the legacy institutions trying to maintain global order and the people physically deployed to uphold it.
Exactly. So today's mission is to synthesize a stack of intense global reports. We're going to start at the top, looking at the diplomatic paralysis at the UN Security Council in New York. From there, we'll trace how that high-level gridlock translates into the field, looking at the rapidly shifting situations for peacekeepers in Lebanon and South Sudan.
Right, the operational reality.
Yeah, and finally, we will navigate the diplomatic back channels in Washington to see how international strategy is attempting to adapt to a world that feels increasingly hostile to the traditional rules of engagement.
It's a heavy agenda, but the through line is undeniable. The operational reality of global peacekeeping is just shifting beneath our feet.
Okay, let's unpack this. We are starting with the view from the top, looking at some reporting from What's in Blue regarding the UN Security Council's agenda for March 2026. The United States currently holds the presidency of the Council for this month.
That's right.
Now, for you listening, if you follow international relations, you'd expect the highest security body in the world to operate on a strict, agreed-upon itinerary. But the diplomatic friction right now is so intense that there isn't even an official program of work for the month.
No.
Instead, there's just a plan of work.
And that subtle change in terminology, it's a massive diplomatic insult in the context of the Security Council.
Guess so.
Well, it signals that the presidency couldn't even rally a consensus on the basic calendar of events. The underlying geopolitical friction here involves China and Russia. They formally objected to the inclusion of a briefing on the work of the 1737 Sanctions Committee.
Which is the committee concerning Iran.
Exactly. And the objection is rooted in this ongoing, deeply contentious dispute over the snapback mechanism.
Right, the snapback mechanism being the provision meant to automatically reimpose the UN sanctions on Iran that were previously suspended under the 2015 JCPOA nuclear deal.
Yes, and the dispute over invoking that mechanism has effectively derailed the Council's administrative functions. I mean, committee chairs hadn't even been appointed heading into the month because the member states were deadlocked. When you have a standoff over Iran's sanctions paralyzing the mere scheduling of meetings, the U.S. is left having to brief the Council strictly in its capacity as the president rather than operating under a universally recognized program.
Despite that bureaucratic drama, the U.S. is pushing forward with a couple of highly specific signature events for their presidency, right?
Yeah, two main ones to note.
The first is an event focused on energy, critical minerals, and security. And the second one is notably specific to the current administration's focus. It's an event on children, technology, and education in conflict, which is specifically being chaired by First Lady Melania Trump.
Right, and that features a primary briefing from the Undersecretary General for Political and Peacebuilding Affairs, Rosemary DiCarlo. But thinking about the broader implications for you, the listener, this paralysis at the highest level of global security has real-world consequences.
It trickles down.
Exactly. When the highest international body is trapped in a procedural dispute over Iran, it sets a tone of institutional gridlock. That inability to build consensus doesn't just stay confined to New York. It delays funding, mandate renewals, and frankly, the operational agility of the UN in active conflict zones where unified action is desperately needed.
Here's where it gets really interesting, because the consequences of that global friction are playing out violently on the ground. We are moving from the boardroom into the escalating situation in the Middle East.
Yeah, things are moving fast there.
Before we dive into the timeline, I want to be incredibly clear with you, the listener. We are looking at highly charged, active conflicts today. Our goal in this deep dive is to report the facts exactly as they are presented in the sources, without taking any political sides or endorsing any viewpoints. We are just looking at the operational mechanics.
A strictly analytical look at the timeline.
Exactly. So, based on the sources, we saw a large-scale attack launched by the U.S. and Israel against Iran on February 28th. In the immediate aftermath, Iran initiated retaliatory strikes targeting Israel and U.S. bases in the region.
And the escalation rapidly crossed multiple borders. Overnight, between March 1st and March 2nd, Hezbollah in Lebanon fired sustained rockets and drones into Israel.
Right.
And they explicitly cited the assassination of Iranian Supreme Leader Ali Khamenei as the catalyst for their mobilization, which, of course, subsequently prompted heavy Israeli retaliatory strikes directed into Lebanon.
Looking at a Xinhua report, this massive exchange of fire directly caught the United Nations interim force in Lebanon UNIFIL right in the crossfire. Missiles actually struck a UN base in southern Lebanon.
It's a nightmare scenario for peacekeepers.
It really is. The strike caused major damage. The officers' mess building caught fire and burned completely to the ground.
And the human cost there is severe.
Two Ghanaian peacekeepers were critically injured in the blast, and a third suffered trauma. The reporting says they are stable, but they are confined to a medical bunker at the UN base, just waiting for a safe window to be transferred to a referral hospital.
What's fascinating here is the immediate diplomatic fallout. Ghana's government didn't just issue a mild statement. They moved instantly, lodging a formal protest at the UN headquarters in New York, demanding accountability.
Right. It's a sovereign nation having its troops fired upon under the UN flag.
Exactly. And that sentiment is echoing across other troop-contributing nations. The Irish perspective here is critical. Ireland has a significant deployment in UNIFIL, and Irish Minister McEntee released a very stark statement.
Yeah, she confirmed all Irish personnel are safe, but then issued a severe condemnation of both sides of the hostilities.
Her statement really cut through the usual diplomatic ambiguity. She explicitly condemned Hezbollah's attacks on Israel, stating they were acting in support of their Iranian sponsor.
And in the same statement, she turned her focus to Israel, condemning what she called a disproportionate response. She specifically cited the aerial bombardment, ground operations, and the sweeping demands to evacuate civilian populations in southern Lebanon and Beirut.
And her proposed solution relies entirely on reverting to established frameworks. She called for all sides to abide by the November 2024 Cessation of Hostilities Agreement and UN Resolution 1701. It's a plea to stabilize the region using agreements that are currently failing to hold the combatants apart.
We are going to pivot our focus from the Middle East down to Africa because the reality for peacekeepers in South Sudan right now is, well, it's a bizarre dual reality. In one region, UN forces are providing critical, life-saving humanitarian aid, and in another, they are being actively kicked out.
It's the ultimate paradox of modern peacekeeping. You're the most vital asset in one county and given an eviction notice in the next.
Let's look at the humanitarian tragedy first. We have reports detailing a horrific weekend attack in South Sudan's Ruing administrative area, specifically Abimham County. Armed youth, suspected to be from Mam County, launched an assault, and the death toll has reached 178.
Including women, children, and the elderly.
Yeah, it's devastating. Over 170 people were buried in a single mass grave.
The UNISFA response to this was immediate. They deployed peacekeepers to establish a protective perimeter for civilians fleeing toward the Abay area. And crucially, a Ghana Level 2 hospital, there's Ghana's heavy footprint, again, is treating the wounded. They are performing emergency surgeries right alongside Medicine Sans Frontieres.
And the incident drew widespread international condemnation from the EU, US, UK, Norway, Canada, and the RJMS. So in Abia, the UN is the indispensable safety net. But then we have another report from Xinhua that contrasts this completely.
Via Kobo Directive.
Right. The South Sudan Army, the SSPDF, ordered the UN mission, UNMISS, and all humanitarian agencies to immediately evacuate their base in Abo. They were given a strict 72-hour window to pack up and leave.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, the SSPDF's rationale points to a highly concerning trend. The army is planning a major military offensive against opposition forces, the SPLAIO. Their objective is to recapture bases that were lost in late 2025 and early 2026, stemming from a previous attack in Nasir.
And again, to be completely transparent with you listening, we are impartially reporting the conflict between the South Sudan government and the SPLAIO here without taking sides.
Absolutely. The army's justification for the 72-hour notice was essentially to clear the battlefield.
Just imagine the whiplash of the UN's position here. You are praised and desperately needed for emergency surgeries in one county, and then handed a 72-hour notice to flee an impending military offensive in another.
Peacekeepers are increasingly operating at the absolute mercy of the host nation's military tolerance. When that evaporates, they have very few mechanisms to hold their ground.
So what does this all mean? How does the international community adapt to these chaotic realities?
Adaptation has to happen strategically and tactically. At the high level, we saw the inaugural meeting of the EU-UN Strategic Committee on Peace and Security in New York.
Right, co-chaired by UN and EU heavyweights like Rosemary DiCarlo and Jean-Pierre Lacroix.
Yes. And they focused on joint priorities for 2025 through 2028, leaning into the Women, Peace, and Security agenda. But crucially, they focused on adapting missions under the UN80 Reform Initiative.
The push to modernize the UN's operational frameworks before its 80th anniversary, because the old model of static bases is clearly vulnerable.
Exactly. And we see a quick example of this tactical adaptation with the ATMIS mission in Somalia. They are actively opening joint operation centers. They are making troops highly mobile, better coordinated with Somali forces, and moving entirely away from those static, vulnerable bases.
But mobility only matters if there's a political process. Which brings us to the prerequisite of peace. We have a Hespers report on the Washington consultations regarding the Moroccan Sahara dispute.
This is a perfect example of enforcing that prerequisite. UN envoy Staffan de Mistura and U.S. officials met to map out next steps. And the core message from the U.S. to the Polisario Front was essentially an ultimatum.
Respect the ceasefire.
Right. The Polisario Front abandoned the ceasefire back in November 2020. The U.S. is saying that before any real negotiations can happen, they have to respect it again.
The talks are based on Morocco's autonomy proposal, which is cited in UN Resolution 2797. But they treat de-escalation as a completely non-negotiable starting point. You can't have a productive political track if the security environment remains tense.
It's an attempt to reduce the operational pressure on the UN mission there, Minurso, before diplomacy even begins.
We have covered an immense amount of ground today on this deep dive. We traced the fault lines of global stability.
We really did.
We started with the political gridlock in the UN Security Council over Iran's sanctions. We followed that to the burning UNIFIL bases in Lebanon, to the tragic mass graves and sudden 72-hour eviction notices in South Sudan, and finally the strict diplomatic conditions being set in Washington.
This raises an important question, though, and it's something I want to leave the listener with. Historically, the UN's blue helmet was a symbol of diplomatic immunity and safety.
Right.
But as we see peacekeepers being struck by missiles, caught in the crossfires of major regional wars, and explicitly ordered out of conflict zones by host nations, we have to ask a hard question. If the blue helmet no longer guarantees physical safety or diplomatic respect on the modern battlefield, how will the international community protect the vulnerable populations that entirely rely on their presence?
That is the core issue right there. Well, I want to thank you, the listener, directly for joining us on this deep dive. We appreciate your curiosity and your willingness to look past the headlines to get a well-informed perspective on the true state of global peacekeeping. Stay curious, and we'll catch you next time.